this that only according to the questions for this meeting. Today on the agenda, we are going to be briefed by the department on the two bills, Employment Equity Bill, Amendment Bill, and the Public Employment Service, Employment Service Bill. We are going to hand over to the person leading the department. And as it is on our agenda, the Employment Equity Amendment Bill will be the one that we are going to do first. Can you lead us?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. The colleagues and members who here today. Chairperson, we just wanted clarity because we informed that we also want a more information on the last one that has come in, and we're not sure whether the item is on the agenda or not.
The item is in the agenda, it's just after the presentation of the tool. It'll come.
Thank you very much.
They have to send, you know, anything about this thing. Because only then, that's all.
Okay. Okay. Is there anyone here who has the technical expertise? Okay, while we have those technical issues, we do have the presentation on paper. Can you, Mr. Mukhani, please talk to what we have? We will follow through really. The vice will come up.
That's what we're just saying, Colin. Yeah. Let's talk to the doctor. Okay. It's not worth it, you know, because it's not
worth it. Thank you, Honorable Chair. And good morning to all members in the House. The Employment Equity Amendment is striving to achieve three objectives. Sir, I think the technology is strong enough this morning, but I can why make some sense to try to. It's not moving. Yeah. So we want to achieve three objectives with the amendments to the Employment Equity Act that was passed by Parliament in 1998. We want to give effect to the fundamental constitutional rights of equality, fair labor practices, and protection against unfair discrimination. If we look at Section 92 in the Constitution, it gives effect to those objectives that we want to achieve. The second objective is that we want to strengthen the implementation and enforcement mechanisms in the Employment Equity Act by looking at increasing the fines, the penalties for non-compliance by those employers that are not complying with the requirements of this Act. And South Africa, which is the third objective, is a signatory to the International Labour Organization. And we have also ratified conventions that deal with discrimination in the workplace. That is Convention 100, the one dealing with equal remuneration for work of equal value, and Convention 111 that deals with elimination of discrimination in occupation. Therefore, we believe that we need to align our national laws in South Africa to fully comply with our international obligations. And we are hoping with the legislation that we are going to see that by the amendments that we have made to certain provisions of the Act, will enable us to achieve these three objectives. Firstly, if you look at the proposed amendment, we are looking at definitions which are contained in Section 1, where we are trying to clarify firstly who is the designated group. Currently, the law says the designated group are black people, women, and people with disabilities, irrespective of their race and gender. And because we are South Africa part of the global labor market, we realize that we have people coming in and out of our countries who are also from our African continent. And therefore, we needed to clarify who are the beneficiaries of affirmative action under the Employment Equity Act. You will see that the definition of the designated group is revised to ensure that beneficiaries of affirmative action are limited to persons who were citizens of South Africa before the democratic era, that is 27 April 1995, and those who would have been entitled to citizenship, but due to apartheid laws and policies that were in place then, they were unable to actually get their citizenship. And this includes their descendants as well. That those are the people that will be covered under affirmative action. And we went further to explain that foreign nationals or those that became citizens subsequent to the democratic era of 1994 do not assist in prior to achieve their affirmative action targets and American goals at the expense of our designated South Africans. So what we have seen in a number of companies that they then look at our neighboring countries, the black Africans from the continent, and they use them to achieve the numerical goals and targets for the purpose of affirmative action. So we are saying that we need to actually implement affirmative action properly by clarifying who are the beneficiaries of affirmative action under this act. We then look at Chapter 2 of the Employment Equity Act, where we are dealing with prohibition of unfair discrimination. If you look at the current Act, the Section 6 talks on the concept grounds of unfair discrimination, looking to race, gender, color, and other, but they are not covering discrimination based on arbitrary grounds. So this section has been amended to include any unfair discrimination based on an arbitrary ground. If an arbitrary ground, we are referring to grounds like I'm shorter than the commissioner next, I'm taller than the commissioner next to me, although we are both female, there's no clear justification why the employer will prefer her and not me, or if the employer prefers her because she's lighter in color, I'm just making an example and I'm a little bit darker than her. That's what arbitrary means. So we have added on Section 6.1 to clarify what the discrimination based on arbitrary grounds. There's been instances where we are both African females, where there is no color, there's no issue of gender, we are both African females, but and doing the same job, maybe we are admin plus, and the employer prepared to give the other African female more money than the other African female. Therefore, the arbitrary ground will actually cover those cases where the prohibited ground doesn't come. And we also want to bring consistency with the terminology that is in the amendment to the Labor Relations Act, dealing with the issue to prohibit discriminatory dismissal based on this arbitrary ground. We further went in the same Section 6 to include new provisions dealing with Section 6.4, it's inserted, it's a new provision that deals explicitly with unfair discrimination by employers in respect of terms and conditions of employment of employees doing the same work, similar work or work of equal value. This principle is very important because it's contained in the ILO Convention 100 dealing with equal remuneration for work of equal value. And in South Africa, it's a new principle. We have been implementing all the provisions. However, it was pointed out by the annual committee of experts that our law has a shortcoming because it doesn't promote equal pay for work of equal value. Therefore, the new Section 6.4 will make sure that we cover that. We further went through the section to elaborate that differences in pay or conditions of work between employees performing the same work of substantially the same work or work of equal value will amount to unfair discrimination unless the employer can show that differences are fair in relation to maybe the experience of the person, but the skill, responsibilities and qualifications. It goes further to the complexity of the portfolios that people actually manage. If we are both directors in the Department of Labor, although we occupy the same rank, our responsibilities and roles and the size and complexity of our portfolios may be different. Therefore, the department can justify why the other director is earning a little bit higher than the other director. But it can be fair based on facts, not on other grounds that are unjustifiable. We also inserted Section 6.5 to enable the minister to issue a regulation dealing with the criteria and methodologies that needs to be applied by employers to evaluate work of equal value. I initially indicated that this is a new principle which is difficult, therefore we need to make sure that we provide the labor market with guidelines through the regulations. Therefore, the Commission for Employment Security will advise the minister on the criteria that needs to be utilized and the methodologies that will assist employers how to deal with this provision. If you look at Section 8 dealing with psychometric testing, this section has always been there to make sure that when employers apply psychometric tests or similar tests to assess the capabilities of employees, it should be scientifically proven that these assessments are not biased based on gender, race, but they are fair and reliable. Therefore, in this provision, we are just making sure that all the tests that are being applied by employers in the various organizations must be certified by the professional body in South Africa. Therefore, if the employers are doing any tests that are not certified by the Professional Council of South Africa, which is the recognized body in our country, but another body which may come later, which is authorized by law, such tests may be used on tests to test the capabilities of employees. Anything outside this which is not certified cannot be utilized because we believe that they are not scientifically proven to be valid and reliable and not biased. Still under the provisions of unfair discrimination, we wanted to make sure if you go to dispute resolution of unfair discrimination cases that we amend Section 10 by inserting Section 10.6 to allow employees an option of referring the unfair discrimination cases for arbitration to the CCMA in two circumstances. I need to explain, Honorable Chair, that currently the law says the CCMA has powers only to conciliate unfair discrimination cases. They cannot arbitrate and issue awards. If you feel unfairly discriminated and you don't feel that your case has been handled properly during conciliation, you only have a leeway of going to the labor court where you need a legal representation, which most of the people don't have resources to actually pay for lawyers. But we are saying now we are flexible. Employees can send their cases for arbitration to the CCMA arising from an allegation of sexual harassment on a prescribed ground. It doesn't matter how much you earn. If it's a sexual harassment case, we want the CCMA to assist and deal with it and arbitrate and issue an arbitration award. And the second circumstance is that lower paid employees, those that are any less than or equal to the any threshold that is described in the BDA of 183,000, currently sitting at 183,000, must have the right to go to the CCMA on any case of unfair discrimination. With this clause, we want to give more access to justice to vulnerable groups. We know everybody that is earning more or less 183,000 per annum are those vulnerable employees in the market. So we feel that we'll be giving them access to justice by allowing the CCMA to deal with their cases speedily without them incurring any legal costs. If you look at the current Section 11 dealing with the burden of proof, even as unfair discrimination case, it says that if an employee alleges that there has been an unfair discrimination act from the employer, then the burden of proof lies with the employer to justify if the discrimination was fair or unfair. So we went back to this law to amend it to bring some consistency in approaches with the current Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act of 2000, it's normally called SEPUDA, to ensure that we balance the burden of proof. In the slide, we didn't cover all the provisions, but if you look at it now, we are saying in cases, if you look at the bill, honorable members, is that in a case where an employee has been unfairly discriminated based on the prohibited grounds that are outlined in the other section 6, race, gender, the burden of proof will be on the employer to justify if it is fair or unfair. But when it comes to allegations of unfair discrimination based on an arbitrary ground, the fact that I'm lighter in color and the other one is darker, although we are both African females, then the burden of proof will then shift that the person that alleges that there's been an unfair discrimination based on an arbitrary ground will then have to put the justification in front of the court to justify why it is an arbitrary ground. We then move to chapter 3 that deals with the implementation of affirmative action. If you look at the current law, section 20 dealing with the employer equity plan has been amended to ensure that all the designated employers who fail to prepare and implement their employer equity plan can be referred directly to the labor court by the director general for a fine, without first securing and undertaking or issuing a compliance order. Honorable Chair, if you allow me to unpack why this provision is so important, is that if a company doesn't have a roadmap, we call an employment equity plan a roadmap or a vision to transform their organization, because that's where they need to evaluate and audit their workplaces to check the over and under representation of women, black people, and people with disabilities across each occupational level, so that they put strategies in place to empower those that are previously disadvantaged and set targets in the same plan to transform their organization. If they don't have this roadmap or this vision to transform, we believe certain organizations doesn't have any intention to actually achieve the objectives of this Employment Equity Act. Therefore, if you don't have an equity plan, the Director General is empowered to refer the matter directly to the labor court. We start giving you a chance through a written undertaking to do the plan. The act was implemented from 1998. It's over 10 years, honorable members, and we believe if we get hold of such employers that don't comply, they should actually get a penalty for not having a vision. Hence, this new clause has been inserted under Section 20. We further went to look at terminology dealing with occupational categories in Sections 15, 16, 19, 20, 27, and 42. I must explain that this is just a technical amendment, because there is a difference between occupational levels and occupational categories. If you look at the objective of the employment equity, was to make sure that people that were previously disadvantaged have equal access to opportunities to occupy strategic decision-making positions. If you look at those occupational categories, it refers to a group of occupational and professional fields. If we have all studied as teachers, we are in the same occupational category, which is a horizontal thing, the professional field. But if you get to a school, you may be an HOD, head of department, and I can occupy an ordinary teaching level. Therefore, decision-making powers vary when we get to the actual workplace. With occupational levels, it then defines the actual power that you have to make decisions and influence the strategic direction of organizations. And we feel that occupational categories add no value to achieve the objectives of this act. Therefore, we have removed occupational categories, we are left only with occupational levels. We went further to look at Section 21. Section 21 deals with employment equity reporting. This is a very important section because it then allows both the department and the commission, including also the country as a whole, to see if there's been progress in achieving the objectives of the Employment Equity Act. It's through the reports that we get from designated employers that we know if we are achieving the transformation agenda of this country. Therefore, we are saying that all reports need to be submitted on time as stipulated under Section 21. And because of employers, we have large and small designated employers. Small employers are those that have 50 or 149 employees. And the current law requires them to submit every 7 years. And large employers that employ 150 to thousands of employees are required to submit annually on the first waiting of day of October. The small employers have approached us in various ways. They have sent emails requesting that the Director General allow them to submit annually. The reason being that it can't come for them to keep records for 24 months. Therefore, we are just aligning that every year we should have both small and large employers submitting on the same year. It makes statistical sense for us to evaluate progress in the country than having different sets of employers submitting at different times. And we also said if an employer fails to submit an employment equity report to the Director General by the first working day of October, then the Director General should be empowered to send the letter directly to the Labour Court. We start securing a written undertaking or a compliance order. I will elaborate more on the written undertaking and compliance order, honorable members, when I get to the section dealing with enforcement, because these two provisions, undertakings and compliance order, actually come back. If we go that route on an employment equity report, then we are not going to enforce this legislation, hence the proposed amendment. If you look at the actual bill that is in front of you, honorable members, is that we also have another provision where we are saying that we should empower the Director General to issue an extension date for submitting reports if employers are going to submit their reports online. So we still remain with the first day, the first working day of October, the deadline for those that prefer to give us manual hard copies at the department. But those that go online and submit through the internet, then the DG can give them some new way to do it up to a particular time. Just an administrative matter that we want request flexibility around the DG having the power to extend the reporting timeline. This is another controversial section, honorable chair, section 27. Dealing with income differentials. I think we have seen the debate in the public arena about the inequalities around income differentials. So we have amended the current section to cater for measures to eliminate unfair discrimination in relation to terms and conditions of employment. That principle of equal pay for work of equal value. We want to link it to this section 27 dealing with income differentials because the current section in the law doesn't cater for the principle of equal pay. It's just to bring that consistency with Prop 64 that I alluded to earlier, to promote work of equal pay. And this will allow the two commissions, because currently the law says employers must submit their income differential statement, which must be analyzed by the Employment Conditions Commission, which is a commission that is established by the DCA, not the Employment Equity Act. So with this commission, they are allowing the two commissions to collaborate to deal with these inequalities from different levels. Under the DCA, when they set terms and conditions and minimum wages, they must make sure that there is lack of equal pay, and also to empower the Commission for Employment Equity to assist in the assessment of work of equal pay so that there is no unfair discrimination. members. I need to just take time on this one if you allow me to unpack the enforcement mechanism of the Act. Remember my second objective earlier when I explained that we intend strengthening the enforcement and implementation mechanisms of this Act. If you look at the current Section 36 of the Act, it deals with written undertakings. It allows the labor inspectors to go to an employer, and if the employer does not comply with the provisions of this Act, or they fail to submit, I'll make an example with the equity report. They fail to submit the equity report, the inspector will default by the current provisions to actually secure a written undertaking. By securing a written undertaking, that the employer gives a promise to the inspector that in 60 days I'll have a report to the Director General. And if you look practically, 60 days can be any time, maybe in the middle of June, whereas the deadline was in the previous reporting year of October. Therefore, when it comes to our offices in the middle of June of the next year, we cannot analyze it because by then the Committee for Employment could have already submitted to the Minister the status of employment it could have reported in the previous year. So that report becomes useless if going the route of written undertakings. And we believe that it creates a loophole for employers to perpetuate non-compliance. And we are therefore amending Section 36, 1 and 2 to make the power to request employers to make undertaking discretionary for labor inspectors. Labor inspectors know the employers that are perpetual non-compliant employers. If they get a workplace and they know that this employer is forever not having an not having an analysis report or not having a single manager responsible for the implementation of employment equity, they should not waste time by just securing another undertaking. They should actually go to the Director General to apply directly to the Labour Court to make that undertaking an order of the Labour Court for non-compliance. Instead of just having a gentleman's agreement. If you look at the second section, which is Section 27, dealing with compliance order, I need to explain the link. If the employer said in 60 days I will give a report in terms of the undertaking, and the inspector pitches up, and there is still no report after 60 days, the current law says the inspector has then issued a compliance order. A compliance order should also give the employer some time to prepare the same report that they were supposed to have prepared in 60 days. So if you make a law for 3 months, you use the compliance order. We are now amending the compliance order to exclude certain provisions like if you don't have a plan, you don't need a compliance order. If you didn't submit the report, you don't need a compliance order. In both the written undertaking and the compliance order, we are saying we shouldn't issue any written undertaking or a compliance order if you didn't submit the report or you didn't have prepared an equity plan. It must go directly to the labor court. Therefore, we are trying to also eliminate the step of objective to compliance order. I need to explain honorable members that after 3 months of issuing the compliance order, if the inspector walks up again in the same employee, the law says the employer has a right to object to the compliance order by writing to the Director General. So if you look at the provisions, Section 39, which deals with objections, we have repealed that section in the bill. That we shorten the cumbersome enforcement mechanism. It's not assisting. Because if you didn't comply, why must you still object to the Director General to the compliance order that forces you to comply? And we are also repealing appeals. If the Director General confirms that the compliance order was meeting the requirements of the law, Section 40 was giving employers another new way of appealing the Director General's decision, which is now another cumbersome step that is added in the enforcement mechanism. So Section 89 and Section 40 have been repealed so that we shorten the enforcement mechanism. We want to simplify and eliminate unnecessary mandatory steps in the enforcement mechanism so that we suspect the transformation agenda in this country. We need to promote equity in the labor market. Furthermore, if you look at Section 42 Honorable Members. It deals with assessment of compliance. It outlines a number of factors that employers, the Director General Inspectors need to take into account when assessing compliance of employers. This is a controversial area that caused a lot of media publicity around the issue of the demographic, economically active population, whether we are using both national or regional, or whether we should actually differentiate. So in negotiations, not like we actually stopped on this session for several times because there was a serious disagreement between the social partners at NEFLEX. Whether we should remove the first condition dealing with the national, the both national and regional economically active population, or whether we should then have a provision that gives power to the minister to make regulations to clarify how employers should implement the national and regional demographics of the economically active population. I need to explain what we mean by economically active population. We are looking at the population between the ages of 16 and 64. These are people that are economically active. Those that are in employment, informal economies, those that are out there looking for jobs. We are not looking at retired people and children that are still at school. And the statistics around the demographics are actually issued by South Africa on a quarterly basis. So it's not generated by the Department of Labor. It's further disaggregated into race and gender, African, colored, Indian, and white in terms of race and gender. So we are able to use that to assist employers to set numerical goals and targets when they want to transform their organizations. So in this provision, honorable members, we are giving empowerment to the minister to make regulations dealing with this economically active population, which is a controversial issue. And this will be done on the advice of the Commission for Employment Equity. And this regulation will also be put in NEFLEX for social partner engagement before it becomes finally published. We sort of made some compromises at NEFLEX because business, online business was vocal that we need to put another provision, if you look at the amendments under Section 42, to make it explicit that an employer may raise any reasonable grounds to justify why it has no compliance. When we were negotiating, we felt that anyway, if you are brought in front of the court, you will have to justify why you didn't comply. So this condition for us is just a here or there. It doesn't actually change anything because anyone has a right, if you are in front of the court, to bring all your factors to court to actually justify your case. If you look under the enforcement mechanism, there is differentiation between what the labor inspectors can do and other powers in terms of assessing compliance, which are vested with the Director General or anyone that the Director General may delegate the power to. And this deals with Director General review. This is substantive assessment of compliance where the Director General can at any point in time identify a company and subject them to a review from sections 43 to 45. I want to link it to this section, why we had to amend this section, so that all of the members should understand where we are coming from. Section 42 says the Director General can identify any company and subject them for a substantive assessment of compliance. Where we ask for information, if you have a plan, we give it to the Director General. We then check if you are implementing the same plan that you said you are having in your organization. We check if your numerical goals are going to help you to transform. We measure it against the economically active population statistics. How many women you said you will have? How many African women in your executive? Did you actually achieve what you said? If not, we want the employer to justify why we don't see any women or black people in their top management, senior management, and so forth. We also go further to check if there are any strategies that support the equity plan that you claim that you are having. And because most employers, when we started piloting this section of review, knew that Section 45 was not tight enough for the Director General to take them to the Labour Court for non-compliance. You check in the Labour Court statistics that since we started with the DG review, the Director General only took two companies to court. It was ComEx, which refused to comply with the Director General's recommendations that were issued under Section 45. But we then lost the case at the Labour Court because of technical loopholes in the Act under Section 42. I want to link it to Section 42 that I earlier alluded to. Hence the amendment under Section 42 to also remove sections that made it cumbersome for the Director General to enforce compliance. We then went to Section 45 during the amendments to ensure that we tighten it up. With the second company that we took to court, they were refusing the request to give the Director General information. You will see in that first paragraph in the slide, honorable members, that we are talking to a request by the Director General and a recommendation. First, we request information. Therefore, we want to inspect the request. If a company fails to give the Director General the necessary information for assessment, we want the Director General to be able to take it to the Labour Court for enforcement, to enforce the request. And if the company still fails to implement the recommendation, we want the Director General to go to the Labour Court without having to be taken on review or the case being thrown out of court based on technical things. You see that we have then built in some time frame so that as a department we should be on our feet when enforcing this law. That if the employer refuses to give us information in terms of the request, then the Director General has 90 days to refer the matter to the Labour Court. After 90 days, it will then lapse. If the employer refuses to implement the recommendation, then the Director General has 120 days to refer the matter to the Labour Court. Failure to do it within the 120 days, then the case will have to start it from scratch. So it was meeting each other with other social partners on this, that the department shouldn't take forever to deal with cases of non-compliance. The following provisions, honorable members, are just the alignment. If we do something on the left, we need to make sure that other provisions are aligned to empower the department and labor inspectors to enforce, including the CCMA. If you look at Section 48.2, we are just empowering the arbitrator at the CCMA who's dealing with unfair discrimination cases to issue an arbitration award. So it's just to bring that empowerment in line with what we have done under Section 36. And under Section 50H, I need to explain why we are amending 50H. It deals with the powers of the Labour Court. Through the ComEx case, the lawyers of ComEx used this Section 50H to convince the court that the Director General's decision to send a letter to the Labour Court didn't meet certain requirements as outlined by Section 58 and Section 42. Meaning the technicalities were around if the court has the right to review the Director General's decision to refer the matter to the Labour Court without following all the factors that were outlined under Section 42. So we have been advised by the state lawyers and senior counselors that were helping us to deal with the case that we need to align this Section 50 to the current Act dealing with promotion of Administrative Justice Act of 2000. So that brings an alignment in the Act of Parliament that deals with administrative justice. Okay, thank you. My mentor, I'm being host, honorable members, is empowerment of women. That's what we call it under employment equity. That I should also mention the fact that this provision, if we amend it, align it to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, no labor court can review the decision and the recommendation issued by the Director General. If we bring that alignment, it allows the Director General that everybody must argue the merits of the case and the case shouldn't be thrown out by the labor court without looking at the merits of the case. So this is a good amendment to bring that amendment and empower us further to enforce. Thank you. Because with the Comair case, we never went into the merits of the case. And we knew that on merits, they didn't comply. And they knew it. And they went to the technicalities in the law. I'm about to finish, honorable members. Others are just the alignments, like I said earlier, and also to simplify the procedures for compliance. If you look at Section 53.5, the current law says that anyone that needs to access state contracts must get a certificate from the minister for complying with the act. And this Section 53 has never been promulgated. It was also overtaken by the BBBE code. So although we have never promulgated this section, we felt that this is an opportunity to amend it to ensure that we also allow the minister to issue a code of good practice dealing with the assessment of whether employers are complying with the requirements of the Act or not for the purpose of getting access to state contracts. For that, if we come back to Parliament and motivate that we promulgate Section 53, then we promulgate it in totality, making sure that we are fully empowered to deal with the requirements of the law. And there must be a code of good practice to guide not only the department when issuing the certificate of compliance, but also our colleagues in DTI when they send out the rating agencies. Once they implement the scorecard, they will then have to first check with the department utilizing the code of good practice to assess compliance. We are just bringing that alignment in this provision. If you look at Section 55.2, the current law requires that the minister must have two separate forms for small employer when they request, and also a separate form for large employer to ensure that we don't put unnecessary burden on small employers when they report under the Employability Act. We are saying with this provision that we must give the minister a discretionary power to decide whether he or she needs to issue two reporting forms or only one form. If the form is simple enough and we have now introduced online reporting where employers can log into the system at any time at night over the weekends to report, then the minister shouldn't be forced by the law to have two different forms. If one form is sufficient, like I alluded to earlier on, that small employers want to submit every year, and we believe on the advice of the Commission of Employment Equity that there's no need for separate forms, this provision empowers the minister to have that discretionary power. That's a technical issue that we need to also be flexible in the law. Section 56.1 describes delegation of power. This we have amended Section 56.1 to ensure that the minister has power to issue the certificate, and if he or she cannot do it herself or himself, then the power can be delegated to the Director General who deals with operations. The current law, if you look at Section 53.2, it says only the Minister of Labour will issue a certificate of compliance. And it's because under the delegations in Section 56, Section 53.2 is not covered there. So we are just bringing a flexibility again to allow the minister to delegate to the Director General when issuing the compliance certificate. Section 57 deals with temporary employment services. We are aligning this section to what we did in the LRA, the Labor Relations Bill. The issue that for the purpose of affirmative action, which deals with having an equity plan, submitting an equity report to the Director General, employees who are placed by temporary employment services with a client for longer than for 6 months and longer will be deemed to be employees of the client. If a temporary employment services place people in pick and pay, and if those people are there for 6 months and longer, those people should then be covered and accounted for in the employment equity plan of pick and pay, and when they report to us, they then have to cover those employees. We are just bringing that alignment there. And also to cover them from unfair discrimination and to ensure that they also benefit from the principle of equal pay for work of equal value. Last, on the other areas, towards the conclusion now, the criminal penalties. We have section 59 and 61 that deals with the criminal penalties that if an employer submits fraudulent information to the Director General, the Director General can deem that issue to be a criminal offense. Then it goes to the justice system, and the current offense is only 10,000. Since 1998, this area has never been amended. So there was agreement on this area that we increased it to 30,000. And you'll see later that we also gave the minister flexibility that for whatever reason, if there is a need to increase this area, then the minister will then exercise the power to adjust the maximum fine to counter inflation without the concurrence of the Minister of Justice. Because the current law says before increasing the penalties for criminality or criminal offense, then the Minister of Labour will have to get concurrence, agree with the Minister of Justice before applying his or her mind on this area. So we are saying we need to bring about flexibility because at times both ministers are very busy and the concurrence may not necessarily happen as soon as we investigate. And with the Commission for Employment Equity that is mandated to advise the minister on the implementation of this act, after they do proper research, consulting with the economists, they should be able to advise the minister to look at penalties for offences, for criminal offences under this act. This covers section 59 and section 61. And to allow also under section 64A, this is a new clause, I need to emphasize that we inserted this clause to empower the minister to adjust the annual handover threshold, which are used to determine whether the employer is designated or not designated. If you look at the current act, we have Schedule 4 that outlines all the annual handover thresholds that needs to be taken into account to classify if you are a designated or not a designated employer. Reason being that we have employers that employ less than 50 employees, but their turnover is higher than what is stipulated under Schedule 4. If in agriculture we have less than 50 employees, but we have a turnover of 2 million and more, you are required by this law to do your employment equity plan and also to submit a report. And it varies per sector, and if you go to construction, then it talks about 10 million. We are saying there must be flexibility. That's why this clause is necessary to empower the minister to also increase the turnover threshold to counter inflation rate. This is the most difficult one. Schedule 1 deals with penalties. There was no agreement at NEDLAC on this area. Employers feel that we cannot link penalties to annual turnover of companies. Turnover, we are not looking at a profit. So, if you link your penalties to a turnover of a company, you are creating challenges. That's their argument. And our argument is that since 1998, penalties that are in the current law have never been increased. Therefore, and have never been enforced because of the cumbersome enforcement mechanism. We are therefore proposing in the amendment that we adjust the maximum fines that are imposed for contravention of the act to reflect the change in the value of money. It's very important. It's over 10 years since 1998. These fines have never been increased. The maximum fine, if you look at the current act, is that it's 900,000. If you are a repeated offender, if it's your first offense, the law says a maximum penalty that can be imposed is only 500,000. And I think if we increase the maximum fine that can be imposed, we'll see some change. People are scared of the penalty. Therefore, in addition, the employer's turnover may be taken into account in determining the maximum fine that can be imposed on substantive failure. I need to explain the differentiation. If you look at the proposed bill that is in front of you, we have different columns. We were trying to compromise and meet the needs of everybody at MedMed. Initially, our proposal, if you look at the bill of 2010, was that it turned over up to 2% up to 10% of the turnover if you didn't comply with anything in the Act. If you didn't consult employees, then it should be 2% of turnover. As we were negotiating, we ended up compromising that for administrative issues or processes like you didn't consult with employees, you should be issued with a written undertaking to consult with your employees within reasonable time. Therefore, if you still fail to comply, as section 16, read with section 17 that deals with matters for consultation, then the court should fine you at least 1.5 million. Those are administrative offenses. If you didn't assign a senior e-manager to take responsibility for implementing internal equity in your organization, as per section 24 of the Act, then the court should fine you also 1.5. If you are a repeated offender, it can go up to 2.4 million. You'll see that the second column under Schedule 1 in the proposed bill. But for substantive non-compliance, now that's where the cut is. If you don't have an equity plan, you have no business. Remember what I said earlier. If you go to most companies, they have business plans with targets that they want to achieve. They have strategies to turn around their companies. We don't understand why when coming to transformation, employers are not prioritizing to have employment equity plans to transform their organizations and put strategies to empower those that were previously disadvantaged. For section 20, therefore, which deals with the plans, and section 21 that deals with the employment equity report, those are substantive issues because without the report, we are unable to determine if there's been any transformation progress in the country or in the labor market. And also, section 44 deals with the Director General review. If the Director General issues you with the Director General recommendation and you still fail to implement the recommendation, he believes those are substantive issues. Therefore, they must carry more weight than coming to penalties. We are therefore proposing that for first offender, the court should look at the data of 1.5 million or 2% of that company's turnover. And it will escalate up to 10% of that company's turnover when dealing with substantive non-compliance. Section 20, Section 21, and Section 44B. It's technology again failing us, but honorable members, if you allow me to just conclude using the card papers or pages. Thank you, God. Before I conclude, honorable members, I just want to summarize the areas of disagreement that were in at NetLeg. There were areas that I need to emphasize why there was disagreement. The first area, we know that as we are going to go in public hearings, there will be oral representation. The first area is section 6.1, 6.4, and 6.5 dealing with the issue of arbitrary grounds, the issue dealing with the principle of equal pay for work of equal value. There was no agreement with organized business. There was agreement between government and organized labor. But business didn't agree with us that we should implement equal pay for equal value. They believe that the current law as contained under section 6 outlining all the prohibited grounds is sufficient to deal with this issue. And our argument is that we are not aligned to the convention unless that we have ratified as a member state promoting equal remuneration for work of equal value. So we are forced as government to align our laws to meet our international obligations. And most important is that we need to ensure that we slow the inequalities when coming to income. Salaries, we have tested this. We've been out when we are doing the Director General review to test the principle. Before we put it in the proposed amendment, we tested it. We've been around. There are disparities, they are glaring. They make CEOs uncomfortable because when we deal with the assessment of income differential, we talk to the CEOs and the CFOs in companies. Some big companies in this country have already considered and they have agreed to the Director General recommendations to put measures in place and to put money to adjust salaries where there's been a disparity based on race and gender, where people are occupying same positions or positions of substantially, which are substantially equal in terms of the value that employees contribute. So there are serious disparities in the labor market that needs to be addressed through these provisions. We therefore feel that honorable members, when you debate on this area, we have tested it. We are not going to divorce the companies, but we are working with those companies on an annual basis to assist them to review their salaries and bring parity when coming to equal pay for work of equal value. Another area is the issue of enforcement mechanism. Section 36, Section 37, Section 36 dealing with certain undertakings. Organized business, again, wants us to keep the sector calm. Issue undertakings, if people didn't do an equity plan, if they didn't submit the report, go back to them. They want the sectors to back and give 60 days, go back and issue a compliance order, then they can still object to the compliance order and they can still appeal. So Section 36, 37, 39 that deals with objections, 40 that deals with appeals, 39 and 40 we are repealing. Organized business wants to retain the status quo. They are not happy that we are shortening the enforcement mechanism. And the other contentious issue, I just alluded to the penalties. Again, the organized labor and government agree, but business is totally against the turnover principle. They don't want anything that touches on the turnover of their company. Thank you very much. I don't know if there are any areas that I left out. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mama Shile. Mama Shile. Yeah, it's not Mashele, it's Mama Shile. But it's just next Mashele. We welcome you to be Mashele. Here's the presentation, honorable members. Can I get those that want to engage with the presentation that was made in the form of a question, comments and clarity. I will take the honorable. I'm sorry, honorable. No, I forget that you are very honorable people. honorable Serge, and then I will take honorable Van Westhuizen, and then I will end with honorable Eric.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Let me make a disclaimer, a bit of disclaimer. I find, you know, the Employment Equity Act quite disturbing for me as a South African. Because one of the things you're trying to do is to bring equity in the labor market. But what you're doing, in fact, we are going backwards very drastically. It seems classified people as blacks and colors, Indians and so on. So on the one hand, we are promoting welfare, doing everything we can to promote non-discrimination, but a piece of legislation like this actually force us to go back to educate people in terms of their race and color. So it's a bit of a comfortable thing for me. Although, in principle, I have always pushed, you know, things that can be different to what I just said, if related to one of those problems that we have. Last question to the committee. the amendments are premised on the basis that there is a lot of resistance from employers to comply. What work have we done to establish this? What is the profile of our company today? And how far do we think we need to go before we are satisfied that we are where we should be? Then I want to get into some of the issues that are brought. One of the things that the legislature tries to do is to take arbitrary next out of determining whether somebody should have a job or not. And yet, at the same time, in certain respects, we give discretionary power to assess that to issue or not to issue to ask for an undertaking. Now, once you give somebody discretion, you are injecting arbitrariness. And during the presentation, a statement was made that the inspectors know who the employers are who are already successful. Now, once you say somebody knows, you already have a preconceived idea about that, how you're going to deal with that. And in fact, if you think it's a bit of a risk, I think the situation in Ekurhuleni, or in the Muslim people who died, has something to do with the fact that these guys knew that he had already been an accident in the previous day and he thought that he was acting with dignity so that teaching them. So I think we need to be circumspect when we give authority discretionary power. You see, the assumption we make is that the person who has the discretionary power will always act in good faith. But as we know, in reality, that's not the case. The issue, and I'm glad there were two of them, which are actually quite vast themselves. This whole controversy about work of equal pay, value is a very nebulous concept. Value is a very nebulous concept. And I can see that we're going to sit for many, many months and many, many years to come with problems about determining whether these two things that people are doing are of equal value so that we can pay them the same. And of course, it adds to the other problem that I'm beginning to have. If we look at all this legislation, we're dumping on the CCMA. We're dumping. We're making all these laws, tightening them. In many instances, we say we're making it looser and easier. But what we're doing is actually making sure that many things don't go where they should go, but they can quickly go to the CCMA. Question. Are we making provision in the budget of the CCMA so that they can take loans? More bodies, more money, more things that they need to do their job. And finally, the turnover thing. I'm surprised that the department seems to be surprised that employers would resist making turnover to any criminal offense or any offense they might have committed. Turnover is a very, very bad measurement of anything in business. I can over 10 million rand and lose 11 million rand and I have no money, so I'm better. And if you say because I can over 10 million and I have committed an offense, you're going to charge me based on my handover, you're not contacting me. Punchline. In a country like South Africa where we have no job, we have to be very, very circumspect when we talk about turnover. Because we will bankrupt companies. And that is why there is this incident. And so I'm saying we need to think very, very carefully about this turnover thing. Clearly during the public hearings, I'm sure this thing will come. But for me, it's a no-brainer. You need to make sure that the punishment meted out matches the crime. If you have the opposite or the opposite of that, you're creating a bigger problem than the one you're trying to solve. There's much more I can say, thank you.
Thank you. Chairperson, I would like to ask the department, what kinds of impact assessments have been done on this law? This law has been around for 15 years. And I think no doubt that this law has had many positive spin-offs effects for our country. But can it be quantified? Can you please tell us, has this law being effective and where is it not being effective, and through our studies have this been proven. The second one, if I may, will refer to the principle of Book of Equal Value. Sometimes employers find it difficult to get employees to work in certain areas. In the past, we used to speak of danger pay and things like that. And the cost of living is also not equal throughout our country. And risks at all workplaces are not all the same. So is that taking into account for this nebulous concept that I think it's referred to of equal value? And the other question that I have is regarding psychometric testing. Our existing legislation speaks of psychometric testing and other similar assessments. Now, it seems to me as if you are now only referring to psychometric testing, but what will happen to the similar assessments? Because there are many assessments that employers deem necessary in order to determine which employee will be the most suitable for the job. Then there's also, and may I just add to that, we recently had a very bad example of where the local government seems tried to do some medical tests in a very crude way, where a number of people have died, I mean, etc. And it seems to be that kind of thing that we should actually focus on now. I do know that medical tests are also covered in the law, but I would have thought that if we wanted to sharpen up on pre-employment testing, that is a field where I think the department should really have applied itself to smart. And then lastly, just for now, what have we done to make the whole compliance and reporting process easier? I'm not convinced that reporting annually is easier than reporting biannually, or whatever you call it, in 2 years. As my colleague has referred to, we are struggling in this country to be the national competitors. We are struggling to lower the cost of employment. We want to put more money in the pockets of the employees. And we can only do that if we do not take such a lot of money in terms of unnecessary high fees for unemployment levies, for compensation fund levies, and so on. And it seems to me what we're doing is the cost of employing people is actually being pushed up. Well, the more we try and, make laws to make it more difficult for employers to focus on what their core function is, that is to produce goods, the best value goods that they've got. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. Let me start by 100. The examination by the department. Also saying that if as a result of the public hearings that we had and in those public hearings, it was not only workers who were made sufficient to put for performance, including employers in all the provinces, that the Committee on Labour, which consisted of the ANC, the Democratic Alliance, the Congress of the People in May, and the IFP, which went around the country, all of us were there. What the department has done is on the basis of the report that was generated as a result of those public hearings. And all these parties that have come out, they agreed on that report. And the department was given a go-ahead now to amend all the labor legislation. I got to the point of going to make that one. That's the first point. Secondly, I think the department is not presenting for participation to agree or disagree. But it will say, here is the work that is left the parliament. We must go ahead too. Then the question now to ask the member of parliament is, what will be the next step? Which I think as a committee, we need to speak to this before 2012, where we said, this year in the department will come and make a presentation, and then we'll also issue advice
inviting people who must comment on the outcome of that day. And then there will be public hearing after that, which then will be followed by the committee now trying to make a final decision. So I don't recall that there's a vote for me to raise this. Or that it will be discussed by my opponent of the partner, owned, and then to make a point what happened to from that text of time. Named it with the presentation that has been made or comments to it. So yeah, I was able to share the work of my point of view at the first time. And we were all aware where the process is in relation to that. So I was able to share. The Minister of Finance on the 27th of Shilatman, he was a speech. He's quite had two entities in the Department of Labor. The Standard Employment Sector and the BMA. And I think what informed the Minister, if I may talk on it with the BMA, is because of the current amendment that are in front of Parliament, that the volume of collective activism will be loaded in. So I think for the Minister to raise that, he saw that now, obviously, there's much work to which was not the competence of the but it will be the competence of the The last point for me, sir, I mean, when it was an investor position, I normally don't ask questions. Because I ask questions when I am engaged in order to finalize the issue that is being presented. It's good because Mr. Ron Wang was here. He used to be General Secretary of Nomura. And I used to be the law organizer in one industrial area in the world of the way to I'm raising this just commenting on the fines the fines of 1998 and the proposals now and link employers to what do they normally do using money. The workers in December 51 were enslaved. The salary is 2005. We went to all the what the legislation has put in place in order to resolve. We have been in Leprechaun, back to the Department of Cultural Organization because they use money. Now, if you can look at the money that employers have used in justifying to make the life of workers to be miserable, and better even the proposal from one city that is coming from that city. Because if you look at those cases, all the cases, you look at the cases that are taken for review by employers, after CMA and other institutions have decided that these workers or these workers have been unfairly dismissed, how much they have moved. But my colleagues decided to come here today and try to inquire. Thank you very much.
Thank honourable members. On this very nice note, can I welcome the real chairperson? You know, the real chairperson, you know, the powers that are becoming thin for me. And honourable Lyne Henry over there, you are welcome, ma'am, to this meeting. I just want to share something very short on this work of equal value and equal pay. There was a time when I went with boys and some neighbors to paint my dad's house, and I promised them that after the work we would have a fry and
I'll give you something. So we went out to change his house and so on, and he was this little boy, my friend's son. He's about 9. We all went, and after we had concluded, I called the boys who were working with him and gave them 200 each. And I gave him 6 cents. And from there he was fed, you know. And I could see that something was bugging this little guy. And then I called him and said, why are you fed now? Because you are no longer so angry. He said, no, as Mama said, I gave him all 100 cents and he gave me 6 cents. And you know, from there, I saw, you know, this little boy, as much as he didn't do the hard work, but he was there all the way, you know, he participated in everything. You know, we were sent around to pick up the little. Yes, and he told us, no, I didn't wet the whole thing. And then after that, when I was giving them all 200 friends, I just gave him cigarettes because I thought, I'm leaving. Yeah. He's young. But he was sad, yes, sir. So, and I mean, I was happy that he was up to me and told me that he actually didn't get. He actually didn't spend his 200 rand. He still sold the 100 rand. I didn't get 100 rand. And I had to make it up to him, give him the 200 rand, because he was with us the whole day. I mean, just imagine if a 10-year-old boy can see that we've worked all together, put in effort, and at the end of the day, I didn't get the same remuneration as those that I was working with. On that note, Mr. Father, Honorable Malok, let's say that he has something to say. I'll just give it to him shortly before I hand over.
May I just quote from the Basic Constitution of Employment Act? No person may require employment a child can work. This bill is to be brought to Cornwall.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. We can grab some tea, those that would want to have tea and water. And then on that note, can we continue with the with the employment term, because we welcome the presentation from you, Ma'am Mashiach. It was a very informative and a very good presentation, but then we'll take the process from what we are supposed to do and continue with the work. Can we continue? Okay, there's a suggestion that while you are changing the presenters to move there, then we can continue to grab something and come back and sit down. So I can have a 2 or 3 minute break.
Employment and productivity, social protected employment, especially in areas where you have people with disabilities who find it very difficult to integrate in employment, women, youth, etc. And a whole range of productivity is also key, and institutional arrangements to implement this is quite important. Now, there's also a slide that we used during Medlet. And as honorable members, we can supply this convention and work with the system to make sure that you have those that information in your fingertips when you engage on this bill at a later stage. Because we went through a number of conventions, although we have not ratified those conventions, but within the Medlet process, one of the things that made us move very quickly on this thing was a common understanding that the various conventions adopted at the ILO, some of them very old, that seek to achieve. For instance, the Convention 2 on unemployment of 1990, the Employment Policy Convention of 1954-3122, Convention 181 that regulates that deals with the whole question of private employment agency and how they should interact with government and how they should conduct themselves of 1997. Convention 142 on Human Resources Development of 1975, Convention 159, which deals with the vocational rehabilitation and employment of every person. This convention was used by a range of countries, Germany, Algeria, mainly, in establishing sectors like ours, and we believe that also in the older days, this convention was instrumental in making sure that it's very, very old, especially that they back 1940 or so, were all first established. There's a convention on the migration for employment, and this deals with the movement of people across borders and how the whole question of corporate or individual payment should be dealt with across countries. And this is a big issue given our situation in the country, the economic migrants and you have organizations that are very much involved in the movement of people across the world and how we should treat them. We have a whole range of refugees, and I'm sure honorable members are also familiar with the Bajoran and a whole range of other incidences that arise when the whole question of migration management is not properly done, because you have in the process documented migrants that come having followed the same procedures and protocols, and undocumented migrants, and that also contributes towards a whole range of problems. But, we look at that, and we gave members of NEDLAC who think of this convention. There's also a United Nations Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which actually outlines the rights of people with disabilities, their integration in the labor market, but also makes the case for protecting those that cannot integrate easily in the labor market, or providing means of support to ensure that they are able to work and integrate freely within the labor market. And we also look at the conclusions and recommendations on employment, development, productivity, growth, and development of 2008, and the recommendation 136 on special schemes recommendations of 1970. Now, this is background information that the social partners at NEDLAC use as a resource because it informs our thinking and also sharpens our discussion on a range of issues. We differ on a number of issues, which I would outline at the end. But I think broadly, given the spirit of the convention and what they sought to achieve, because we are also a member of the international body, we managed to come to an agreement on a range of aspects when it comes to this thing. Now, the bill, like we said, it seeks to repeal those provisions that are in the Skills Development Act relating to employment services and productivity, and create a new home and stand-alone act arising out of the coordination. And it also provides a legal framework for the functioning and repositioning of public employment services within the Department of Labor. As we have said in the memorandum of the object of the team, with the assistance of the RFO, we look at the key focus of ministries of labor across the world. And the three are the key, although some departments also focus on social security, etc., with both unemployment and unemployment insurance funds and compensation funds playing a key role as active, that is, activation labor market program, which are a means of software measures when people lose employment. That is how they are used. And it also provides a legal basis for the establishment and functioning of productivity, SA, and something that the department has for years been, we had matters of emphasis on this matter, that we have had shelter to implement strategies established in the terms of a cabinet division. And when the TFMA came into being, it required that all entities funded by government must be established in terms of a law. And until then, we still have entities that exist, well established, but there is no home in terms of legislation that establishes. And hence we sort of also dealing with this aspect, provide a legal framework for the establishment of protected employment enterprises. And that is why people moved away from shelter employment sectors, because it has specific connotations that the disability sector made a representation of, and we looked at international trends. And so there are various problems around the shelter, the notion of shelter. Now, the bill itself, it provides for the functioning of employment, that is the function of employment services, and these functions are free to work seekers in the country, but also it deals with the whole question of employment of foreign nationals. Our constitution has provisions around the employment of citizens, but also every country has laws, and we have interacted with the Department of Home Affairs, and increasingly they are of the view that in that the review of their legislation, the labor migration management is not something that is within the ambit, and you should actually go to the high school state, that is the Department of Labor. They want to concentrate on the visa, and they want the department to say yes or no, and they will act on the basis of it. Because currently there is confusion, and there are a lot of loopholes that a number of companies are looking to bring in migrants, and also once migrants are in the country, because of the protection measures that are not adequate, there is a lot of pain, especially of undocumented migrant workers, which the convention requires us to virtually protect. I must say that even though our law does not make a distinction between documented and undocumented migrant workers, our law makes provision that both documented and undocumented migrant workers must enjoy same status, same protection in terms of the basic conditions of employment protection. But the issue is that when it comes to conditions for bringing in migrant workers, especially in those areas where we don't have sufficient skills, we have been looped, and as a result, migrant workers come in large numbers to the corporate payments. They leave without some sort of skills, and we end up being dependent, or at the end of the project, there is no measure that ensures that the transfer of skills happens adequately. I'm sure all of you, when you travel abroad, you know if you go to the United States and so on, they require you to fill more than 17 pages of immigration statement just to land, in some cases, even when you are in country, let alone staying in the country for 2 or 3 months. And those are measures that are implemented to make sure that if you come or arrive and perform remunerative work in those countries, that is done in a framework that is controlled through the Act. And we work with Home Affairs to make sure that we have that provision in the Act, because no other legislation within the Department of Labor deals with this aspect. The other provision is that the Minister is empowered to establish schemes to promote employment and to minimize retention. Now, the notion of schemes is something that is very common, and in situations such as what we had in the last 4 years during the economic downturn, governments have had measures that they used to intervene. We must be the first ones to acknowledge that registering and taking students once you are successful in those instances where people have the necessary adequate skills or where they have less skills, you can refer them for additional training. We used to do the same within the department to close those gaps. But then we used to have a program, and these programs are common internationally, and those programs are meant to address the large number of people, especially adults and young people who have reached a certain age, working age, who are not keen to go back into the normal mainstream schooling and would want to do a program that will enable them to either enter self-employment, short-term employment, and so on. And broadly, those are schemes. But certainly, there are with business, especially 2008, like in the pension. And we've had social plan interventions, but social plan interventions have not had any regulation up now. And what the bill seeks to do is to also provide a framework that will allow the minister to systematically intervene in those areas where we face possible like a retention. For companies to be able to access UIF, we formulated a concept around paying their fee. But if you go to all our legislation, it's not properly legislated. And what we need to do is to also formalize those arrangements. It also provides for the registration of private employment agencies. Now, we do have a convention on private employment agencies. The truth is that if you have this organization all over the country and they do not comply certain strictures or registration requirements, you end up with problems. We have a national organization, APCO, the Association for Private Employment Organizations, that also made a representation on business that has for years tried to ensure that they deal with unscrupulous private employment agencies. Some of you may have heard stories of people who put adverts in newspapers requesting people to deposit a certain amount of money with a guarantee that they will find employment within a few days, a week or two. Now, because of the sale of unemployment, a lot of people are gullible and they end up depositing 500 grand or so, because people are desperate only to find the bank organization that not exist. It's a bank account that is open, and then within 3 or 4 days that bank account is netted. You know, you can imagine if in one specific area you have close to 1 million people depositing money in those accounts and they vanish. So the whole idea is to protect workers from unscrupulous private employment agencies that are operating in this area, because in an environment where unemployment is high, some entrepreneurs emerge and they make money out of the misery of the poverty. So that provision is aimed at making sure that we can police or regulate those private employment agencies, but at the same time, if they don't comply to the regulation or the registration requirements, we are able to deregister. Now, linked to this provision of registration of private employment agencies, we debated this issue extensively at NET. Now, there are some PEAs that also perform or operate as temporary employment agencies. And that is why in the Labor Relations Act, the 198 provision, the cross-referencing of registration of TEA, temporary employment agencies, through the public employment agency. So, over and above the registration of TEA, because of the amendment in the Labor Relations Act, once those amendments are included, they will also bring within the public employment services the registration of TEA, because there is a very, very thin line between TA and PA because they also indicate into some instances. We also define prohibited acts by PA, the dos and the don, which will normally lead to their deregistration, and the conditions under which they can charge fees or they cannot charge fees. Because if you look at soccer players, all sorts of things happen there. There are managers who emerge and they are called agents and they negotiate on behalf of players, etc. So in those cases where people are professional, we exclude those areas. But there are other areas where people also deal with human beings. They trade in human beings because they place people for a fee and requires an employer to pay a fee. And this is very common in what is normally called a labor contract or TA. So this provision also clarifies the conditions of how they should be charging fees and things that they should not do. But also there's a question of retention of information. You may know that where people are desperate, people collect individual information, and information that is basically confidential and related to the individual. There is some information that can be used towards the detriment of the person, and therefore, or in the long run, end up jeopardizing the person's ability to find employment. Or there is information that people can use, and you end up with the web seeker falling in, you know, the hands of human traffickers. We have had incidences of people who are desperate looking for employment, calling, having agencies calling their information to such people, and that information falling into the wrong hands. So the provision is to make sure that duly registered PEA are able to contain or make sure that the information that is entrusted with them is kept confidential, and it is only released to a prospective employer who is serious about employing a web seeker that is registered with them, and that they also do certain checks and balances before they release such information to such an employer. We also have a provision that deals with the Employment Services Board. Now, this bill has a number of regulations. There are a number of aspects that will require advice to the minister. Obviously, in the legislation, you can't write everything. There are regulations, there are things that the minister will have to do in the near future. Now, in order to make sure that the minister is advised accordingly, regulations are formed and consulted, and that before things like schemes and so on are launched, there is consultation with social partners and so on. The whole notion of Employment Services Board is introduced. Remember, in the Skills Development Act, we have the National Skills Authority, and with the transfer, the National Skills Authority no longer has jurisdiction to deal with regulations relating to employment services. And for the last 3 years, regulations that have been developed under the Skills Development Act could not proceed simply because there was no board that could assist in the processing of those regulations. So the provisions under the Employment Services Board covers how this board should be established, how it should be constituted, what its powers are. This is not an executive board, it's an advisory board, and the functions are clearly outlined, and the constitution of the board is also provided for, that is in terms of its procedures and how the board should actually go about conducting its business. Now, Chapter 4 on Productivity SA is a provision that exists in the Skills Development Act, and with the repeal of the Skills Development Act, we may have problems, and currently it remains in force And what they have done in the Skills Development Act is that although they amended the act, there's a provision that says the minute this employment services bill becomes law, then all the provisions that relate to employment services, including productivity in South Africa, that are currently contained in the Skills Development Act, will then be received in that act. So that there is a legal basis to ensure that productivity continues to operate. So if you look at this section, basically it was an importation of a old section from the current Skills Development Act as it stands to the employment services bill. Now the protected employment enterprises, these were factors that were established through a cabinet decision, and what the AG and Treasury was saying was that we continue to fund you and you don't have education, create a home for this enterprise. We listened to presentations around sheltered employment practice. Now sheltered employment practice has this connotation that you confine people with disabilities to specific factories and you make sure that they don't integrate in mainstream economy. However, after looking at various options and the reasons and conventions as why these factories are actually established, there is a case to be made that yes, where school disabilities can be assisted with, you know, through buzzeries, through assistive devices, through additional assistant personnel and so on, the goal should be to make sure that people with disabilities participate actively in the mainstream economy. However, in a whole range of countries, they do have sections of people with disabilities that ordinarily should be confined to social grants. But those people have been proved, and in some cases it has been proven, that you can also put measures that can assist those categories to be productive and take them off the social grant and give them an income that is higher than what they should ordinarily earn from the or get from the social grant. And we work with psychologists and psychiatrists within the staff to basically provide us with some kind of feeder change as part of making sure that people who have gone through this test that do not actively participate in the formal economy as such. And those are people that we are employing in sectors. There are also similar sectors, about 300 people that are subsidized by the social department. We also provide subsidies to sectors, other sectors that are the blind. We also provide subsidies to organizations of people with disabilities to assist us in identifying people who are working in some of these sectors and finding employment in the mainstream economy. And we pay them on successful placement and integration of such people in the mainstream economy, because we all believe that people with disabilities should be integrated in the mainstream. So this provision firstly provides a legal basis for the existence of protected employment factories. Their mandate is that currently we are operating on the basis of a secular issue by the Department for Public that is Public Administration and the National Treasury. And in summary, Honorable Chairperson, like you said, the bill repositions the provision of employment services within the department and clarifies the role that employment services should play. And it provides a list of regulations that the Employment Services Board is going to have to develop to regulate private employment agencies and a whole range of areas as described in the in the bill, because we should not come up with all those provisions within the bill. And it also provides for productivity as a protected employment enterprises. And lastly, it also provides for the fund that the court can impose in case of non-compliance. Now, just in conclusion, one slide that we also added, which is not in your text, that was on my notes, but I thought that I should put it up there. During the NEDLAC process, I must say I've sat through all the bill negotiations, but if there is one bill that, even though it is long because of the issue, where we seem to find each other, both labor, business, community, etc., was this one. Having said that, there are a few things that are going to come up during the hearing process that was mentioned. For instance, labor raised this issue around consultation on employment schemes. But basically, the concern was not more about the schemes themselves. Basically, they wanted to make sure that we consult extensively on the schemes and that the establishment of the scheme should not necessarily lower current rights that people are enjoying or should not undermine existing employment. That was the issue that they raised more. And the question was whether it do that within the employment services board or you must again go back to NEDLAC. Now, there are provisions that we put in there. For instance, the conditions of people who are not necessarily unionized, the employment commission, that commission normally does this because if you look at NRC's, all those areas that are not unionized, they normally come up with several determinations, and the commission has got representation from all stakeholders. And we didn't see any reason why this issue around conditions of employment for people in King should actually go back to NEDLAC when there is a body with the necessary legal authority to deal with the question of King. There is an issue around the question of registration of private employment agency is not an issue, but because of the cross-reference in the LRA, that suggests that the employment services section should register also temporary employment agencies. You know that there has been this long-standing issue of banning labor brokers of temporary employment agencies. So we know that when labor makes a representation, they will not be making it within the context of the employment services, but I'm sure they've raised this issue in the context of the LRA. But they also acknowledge that there is a very, very thin line between PEA and TEA that we will have to deal with going forward. On the business side, the issue that they raised obviously has to do with the inclusion of the community sector in the employment service board. They believe that they should not be involved and that it's a matter that business, labor and government can deal with in a tripartite. And both community, government and labor were strongly of the view that if the core focus amongst others is unemployed people with disability, women who constitute the majority of the community sector, then it is, you know, we should make a case for the involvement of the community sector within the employment services board. I think the other issue that they raised and that they continue to raise was the whole question of reporting of vacancies by companies. This is something that came out strongly within here, but there has been a compromise that was found in the bill. Firstly, is that certain categories of vacancies will be required to be registered. But there is a provision that if the Minister of Labour believes that companies are not coming to the party, then that provision can kick in to force a company to register vacancy. So, you know, there must a main issue came in and we reached an agreement around it. And the thing that is always raised, I think, the need for legislative checkup. This is the common thing that they are raising, based on saying that they were signed last 2002 and therefore another year should be done. However, our argument, and this is something that we raised when we went to Parliament, that the 10 laps and the issues raised were predominantly addressed during the negotiations. The disability sector, and this is not something that is coming from all sections of the disability sector. It comes from some sections of the disability sector, and it is something that is common, and it basically says, look down shelter employment sectors, don't confine people with disabilities in those sectors, let them be targeted in the mainstream economy. And we pointed out that there are conventions that are in place that deal with this specification, and South Africa is not unique. And you have to have, you must have measures that you need to use to intervene in this regard. And if you use that a country expanding this practice even to other provinces and making them productive and making sure that they show government contracts could be one way in which we take people off the social grant mainstream, especially those that can still be productive and make sure that they end over and above the social grant allocation. The issue raised by National Treasury had to do with a provision that deals with the funding of employment services. Basically what they were saying, and I'm sure honorable members are aware of the criticism that continues to be labeled to the unemployment insurance fund, that the fund is really well beyond currently standing at 82 billion rand and we're moving beyond. Now, while this fund is an insurance in case of loss of employment, most countries have also used actively the fund in terms of labor activation programs to create employment and to make sure that people either don't lose employment or where there are dangers of losing employment to come up with measures such as any layoff to prevent possible loss of employment and to make sure that you reintegrate them back into the economy. So they were basically saying that we must ensure the alignment and that is why the conditions under which the UIF can fund employment services. And this is common throughout the world because this fund have specific tables, but for certain activities they can fund those under specific conditions. And what they propose, something that is not contained in the bill, but something that our legal people can work with state law advisors, is to come up with a provision that can be contained in the current employment services bill that aligns, that amends the unemployment insurance act to make sure that, and the compensation fund, to make sure that that funding can then happen. Lastly, on home affairs, I think this has to do with the whole question of labor migration management, that as the policy on migration, labor migration management is amended, and home affairs removed the labor migration management aspect from their law, that the Department of Labor increasingly should be taking those responsibilities, although the Department of Home Affairs retains the responsibility of actually issuing the visa. They want us to increasingly do, I mean, they want to increase to issue those visas on the recommendation of the Department of Labor and to assist them in the whole question of the management of the inflow of guests and to work with the Department of Higher Education training on ensuring the transfer of skills where we recommend the issuing of work permits. So briefly, those are some of the issues that we believe during the hearing they didn't come up, and I'll make this slide available. And what more? Thank you.
Then, honorable members, this is the presentation. Do you want to reflect on it? The most questions, clarities, and comments. In the short term, I'll give you the honorable Pastor Sayles, and followed by honorable Mutau.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's my impression that the Department of Drugs or people that provide, I call it placement services, the register. Now there are many institutions, and especially expected nowadays from, for example, training institutions, to also assist their students with their placement in places of work. Sometimes for study purposes, but sometimes also in terms of permanent work situation. And my question is just, my interpretation of this bill is that those institutions that assist students, that ask for money, that assist in placing with employees, that they must also now register as providers. If not so, you could just put out that clause to me. And then also, there are also non-profit organizations who give free service in terms of, you know, assisting people to find employment. Do we now require of them also to register? My intention was, what we are trying to curb is this unscrupulous behavior where people ask for money from people, they bring your CV, private CV, and I'll look for a job for you. And then they never find employment for those people. And it seems to me as if this bill is now really going very wide, as I said, including educational institutions as well. Thank you.
Just a question of clarification. I have this nagging feeling at the back of my mind regarding the inclusion of productivity estates together with what you proposed to call the protected employment enterprise. My understanding is that productivity estate is possible. Every company, everywhere in the country who needs help with whatever they are doing can go to them and they can work with them and help them become more productive. My concern, and I don't know if anybody else agrees, is if we put it together and make, because we just don't know where to do it, together with this, the protested employment, it gives the impression that it's only intended to support protested employment enterprise. And that could have, in my view, a negative connotation to some of the other people. I don't know if you have an opinion about that. Just to set my own mind about it.
Thank you, sir. Let me again welcome the report. Correct me if I'm wrong. One of the he was sleeping. He's trying to page everything that was before. He wanted to talk even if there was nothing to say. The one of the objectives of the bill is to coordinate the demand in common trials in the country, both in the public and private sector. That work then is by making sure that anybody that has to do with the government, they have registered for that, is within that competition. The second point, sir, is the issue of shelter deployment services.
relative to what happened to participate in the public transport administration for the I think it's tomorrow. There's a meeting where public transport administration are supposed to give a report in terms of how far the public transport is in terms of employing civil companies. Now, the work that I'm intended to do with special development companies. What is your relationship with the work that the public transport is doing? And I think linked to that, you raised this point, and it was raised last week, by accepting the Supreme Court of Africa to the Foro Commission last week. So it looks like the creation of the standard government person. It looks fancy to work with people with disabilities at eight, and then there's no caliphate, there's no some kind of integration in the society. What is your thinking? I understand what you're saying in terms of how do you have what going forward with social development purpose, but within that that of grace, how do you in touch with the fellowship?
can you in the future have possible development for these certain people if the need for training those that are in their database, they do that. How are we actually going to work with the private employment services, and how are we going to compete with the cost for us?
qualified for, and that job happens in the modern case.
wiped out from
the issue is that we should facilitate internally the movement of that person to take up employment in that part of our own country, rather than to say within the northern states we don't have a suitably qualified person and therefore issue a corporate tender to a foreign. That's the one thing. Because you need to promote the movement of people in the country, because these are citizens that must move in the country. The second issue is that the Department of Labor and Home Affairs, we have on the registration form, and we have appeared before the portfolio committee on Home Affairs, where we discussed this issue extensively around the issue of corporate tenure. The issue is that there is acknowledgement on the side that where they have issued corporate tenure without due consultation with the Department of Labor, they have created problems in the legal. Let me give you an example that is currently pending, and I'll ask Mr. McCarthy to come in. Your sectoral determination that the tax issues of retirement come up, and an employer comes to the Department of Labor and Home Affairs to say, I want to bring in 1,500 people from other Zimbabwe, etc. And these are not skilled workers in this category. Now, what does it suggest? It suggests that either those people can be brought in the country and subjected to lower level standards. It suggests that we must employ people from foreign countries irrespective of the number of unemployed people that are in the country. Some have even gone to the extent of saying local people, and this is something that is picked up. Some of them are drunk, some of them are lazy, some of them, you know, there are all these stories that are said, and so on. Irrespective, and without verifying that information, without concrete evidence that some of the things that have been said are true or not. Now, this deals with the formal, you know, bringing in of people that you can document, etc. But I would want Mr. McCarthy to comment on the question of undocumented. I know, Honorable Mashaba, normally we will not deal with people who are undocumented, but you do have a convention that you have to comply with in case it happens to be in the country, because there are serious issues. This person does in effect. Now you can't say this person is undocumented and therefore we can't deal with that give or the case, etc. When they come to the Department of Service, obviously we want their IDs and all that, and there are procedures that we work with the Department of Home Affairs in case people are not documented, or in case we get such a fine, both people working somewhere and they don't have any kind of paper. I think Mr. McCarthy should come in on the rights of migrants.
Thank you. Members, the issue of the rights of workers in the country is a constitutional issue. It's not a convention issue, it's a constitutional issue in country. Our constitution guarantees that all workers have got the right to fair labor practices in the country, irrespective of whether you are documented, you are not documented, you are legal, not illegal. If you've worked, you've got a fair labor practice. As a result of that constitutional provision, the constitutional court pronounced on the interpretation of that constitutional provision that no worker should be disadvantaged on the basis that they are illegal. If an employer is not enough to employ undocumented or illegal workers, those workers should be entitled to all the rights other workers are entitled to share. They should be able to go to the CMA if they are treated under them. The issue of documentation is a separate process that they could be dealt with. And that's where the legality of the issue comes directly from our constitution and the interpretation of the provision of that provision of the Bill of Rights by our constitutional court.
Thanks. Now, if I can take on the question of, there are a number of questions that relate to protected employment sectors, and Mr. Nondwang will come back.
So the question that relates to the role of the fatality aspect and the relationship that it has with the short employment discussion. When we concluded the turnaround topic for the sections, which is currently under implementation, a component of the strategy entails the national startup advisory team composed of the different sectors, the government and entities with regard to issues affecting the different sectors. And for that reason, therefore, with regard to generating new quarters of the various provinces in the advisory team, the different sectors will play a key and strategic role with regard to the transformation of the turnaround strategy of the country. So for that reason, what happens, the development of the sector is involved in the turnaround strategy of the country. To answer that question. Secondly, the question that relates to ex-combatants or military veterans. The turnaround strategy entails, at the moment, the stabilization of structures. Stability entails financial stability, organizational and administrative stability. Those are the key aspects of the moment, and for the last 2 years, stabilizing the existing entities, because for quite a number of years, there's been instability in those entities, and therefore generating more ways to generate income in the next 3 years, and in that process, both within and without, create a better opportunity. What have been seen within the existing prior structures in the center of the 9 provinces create opportunities and then establish in the rest of the other 2 provinces where there are no structures, new structures, and we think that with that strategy, then we may then be able to ensure that ex-combatants of military veterans get training for accreditation in the existing structures and the new structures that will create both in Mpumalanga and the Bongo. So the nature of the relationship continues to exist, but at the moment we are focusing on stabilizing the existing entities. I suppose that with regard to
Maybe just also add that I think we did also indicate that there is Convention 159 and the United Nations recommendations on people with disabilities. But I think also it would be important for honorable members to also consider the provision of the military veteran act, because it actually also comes up with a dispensation for the military veterans and basically remove them from the sector. We must acknowledge that in the previous dispensation, initially people who were after assessment, either through trauma or either through exposure and all that, and mentally they were found to be unfit to continue to discharge their services in their normal operational duties, they were confined to those sections. So there are certain elements that need to be looked at, but we're also looking at those conventions as well. Let me take on Honorable Funder's question around the registration of organizations. Now, The issue here is that there is a convention that deals with private employment agencies, agencies. the convention adopted at that level says if you are providing this service, there are the protocols within which you are supposed to do it. Now, it will be very difficult to have NGOs and other operating within the space, say we are non-profit, we are whatever, but at the same time, cannot subject themselves to that routine that they are compliant. I mean, we're not saying organizations that are providing education to countries, South Africa, etc. Those should get the normal accreditation through the education stream, etc. But the minute they start operating in this area, because they can do certain things that can get them into trouble with our sector. If for instance we find that they are collecting people's information and are passing that information on to agencies that are dealing with human trafficking under the disguise that they were finding employment for those people, how do we deal with such officials so that enter into an area that has got lost and they happen to be an organization that is established for something else, but they are operating in this environment. I guess when we require registration, we should show compliance to set a minimum standard when it comes to the provision of employment services. And I think Honorable Nyakemba addressed this issue, because if you want to make sure that if you are operating in the space, you have to apply and abide by certain rules. If you don't want to rather pay out because you make a problem for yourself and for the work you have, including companies and yourself. And it's not a blanket registration for everyone. But I did say that there is a very difficult situation that we have to deal with as men. And that is a thin line that exists between the PEA and the TEA. And therefore, that is why there's an agreement that you need to register both, because an organization may be doing this other services only find that they are performing temporary employment services or temporary employment services in its function. And hence, there's an agreement that in order to avoid this situation or that, you need to have both registered and to clearly indicate what their roles are. The inclusion of productivity as aid and protect health internet services, these are two distinct chapters and it's not lumping the two together. The chapter on productivity as aid is very clear. It makes provision for the establishment of the entity. The constitution does not take away the participation by social partners, including the role that productivity should play. But at the core, and the reason why it is within the ambit of the employment services, is that part of employment preservation or employment creation is productivity. Because unless you grow employment and unless you assist companies to be productive, you are likely to lose employment through retention. Hence the same again. This is a common phenomenon that we look at in a number of internal legislation in a number of countries. In some countries, they do have a stand-alone but very small legislation that deals with productivity. But its synergy with employment services is always understood, because unless you intervene to improve productivity, you are likely to lose employment. And if you your productivity increases, that translates into gains in terms of employment. There was a question that Honorable Nyakemba raised around the relationship with DOA. In the main, the Department of Labor, and this was demonstrated in something that the Department was commended upon by the Human Rights Commission, including DPSA, is that over and above the mainstreaming or employment of people with disabilities in the Department of Labor offices, we have a specific and targeted program that does not pay lip service to people with disabilities, but it is actively involved in making sure that people with disabilities are engaged and participate actively in income generation. So that is where the question of DCSA is monitoring the employment of people with disabilities within government. But this program, over and above our employment equity intervention, goes beyond that because DCSA is really actively involved in direct employment of people with disabilities. Obviously, the turnaround strategy, etc., if you get the question right, we are hoping to expand current employment from 1,000 to 3,000, and hopefully if we can get enough funding and contract with other departments, it will mean that we can establish new factories in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, because those are two provinces where we don't have such factories. There was a question on competition between PAs and public employment service. It's true that competition will be there. However, there are two distinct roles. Public employment services throughout the world services the poor, the people that cannot afford the high fees, and so on. That are ordinary, the mainstream. We conducted job fairs in this country, and we continue to run many job fairs in the Department of Labor Office. We are convinced that people require this service, and they can't and must, because ordinary people want information, they want to work with people that understand the situation, etc. Private employment agencies are not interested in the lower and medium market. They are interested in taking professionals and hiring people both local and overseas, because they're in a profit-making environment. They get their money from successful statements of a person in a factory up to 500,000 or 300,000. But they also enter into an agreement. If you take the football case, for example, or a boxer, people doing the driving, golf, etc. Those professionals end up signing, you know, either 50% of their gross income to an agent who is actually doing the negotiation and placement, etc. Because they can't negotiate as a contract over 50%. And most of the TAs are operating in those areas. That is why we say, I mean, we want competition in those areas. People are willing to pay and the voluntary surrender 50% of their income. We can't stop them. But in the long run, that is becoming a problem. Even the players will say, look, we need protection on some of the shots because I'm fighting, I'm fighting, I'm a boxer, and I end up with a brain damage, etc. And all my money is gone to a, you know, to an agent because I don't have the technical capacity to negotiate with this agent. They are with a very special employment for me, and they only take me and they are savings in their human being. The person is doing all the work, they do the negotiations and get half the money or almost 3/4 of the money. So there are conventions also that regulate how the PEA and the public should actually interact. In fact, we have been having discussions with APSOM around working relations and so on, and I think the demarcation is very clear. In some instances, they are willing to assist us in terms of a good number of a large number of people, because to them, it doesn't make money or does not contribute towards their money. The perception around the question of corruption in terms of favoritism to place firstly our next of kin when vacancies arise as opposed to working out the government wants to deal with that issue. And I will also comment on that issue on measures that we are implementing, especially to deal with we're dealing with human beings, their codes of conduct, but the other can talk on the system, because there are, it's not foolproof but we have done a lot to prevent those kind of things. It's not an easy problem.
Of different people using our system. We have tried to make sure that when an opportunity is registered at a system, the system automatically matches the people that are already registered at a system that meet the criteria of the facility. And when we send the CV to whoever registered the opportunity, we have put onto the CV a watermark that is matched by ESSA. And if you're matched by ESSA, it means it's an automatic match by the system, so it was not manipulated. There have been instances where CVs were forwarded that are saying not matched by ESSA. And in those instances, we do have the supervisors that tend to see why those were sent. In some instances, it may be hoped that slip through, but in other instances, we find that if we do not find the people, then we go and do treatment specifically for the opportunity. And it will not be met by it. But when we put the movement watermark, we have to avoid the situation of people matching and seeing their relative friends.
Now, talking about this, we are also, for ethical reasons, going to be introducing a code of conduct. There are ethics. If you look at the career counselors, they are governed by very, very strict professional codes when they conduct counseling or assessment of individuals. These are registered people that have to abide by the professional ethics, because if they disclose information that relates to a candidate, to witnesses and so on, without the consent of the website, etc., they can delay them. Now, in terms of staff operating on our system, just like in practice, there's a move to formulate a code of conduct that will be negotiated with unions to make sure that the transgression of those codes of conduct can also lead to legal processes, because you don't want to leave some of the things to come. People need to know, and I think this is something that when you have law enforcement agencies or officials that are entrusted in positions of this nature, treatment, you need to make sure that you have measures. Now, Honorable Chairperson, your comment around the program of action implementation, this is something that we have been thinking of from the time we came up with the draft, and even when the submission statement was done. The big question looking at the capacity and the resources, including the office space, for everyone for this session, I'm sure that you may have seen in Germany within a radius of 5 to 10 kilometers, we have 5 to 10 employment places in those countries, because the same is part of that. We embarked on a process to get our colleagues in pressure to understand what it means in public employment services. In fact, the Minister of Finance, during his G20 intervention, and this was also instruction by the president of the G20 country, that this year, for the first time in G20, issues of employment creation and growth should be addressed by both ministers of labor and finance, and that the two should come up with concrete recommendations. So in the process, we believe that our colleagues in finance are now beginning to understand that the investment of billions on their side on the infrastructure project aimed at creating employment will not succeed unless they work continuously with us. we are working together on this project as a community to fill the transnet project, etc. And people are beginning to understand each other's role. And we have developed extensive plans that are looking at every section of the field to make sure that we are ready the minute we pass the field. In some instances, we have piloted some of the content and we have developed rough regulations so that as we the ability are not already 10 steps ahead in terms of our plans to prepare for the actual implementation. So some of the content are not new, can still cover in the future. And we would like to share some of those plans with you as well. Thank you.
At this point, I would like us to pray to the Jonathan. I don't know who to speak into the invitation that you can serve to the Jonathan. So we need to the Jonathan of the specific plan that we are performing here in the past.
Thank you again, honorable members. In my capacity also as the acting COO in the department, I'm also charged with the responsibility that is over and above my responsibility of public government services. The operations in the province, including planning and monitoring and evaluation, have also become a responsibility since November last year. Now, one of the challenges we had on the government is that we published and tabled a threat plan 2012-17 and a performance, that is an annual performance plan 2012-2018 in time early last year. Now, a number of shortcomings were identified in the process. Among them was that our APP, in some cases the indicator and the strategic objectives were not fulfilling the MAT principles. We also were confronted with the new guidelines that were published by the National Treasury, which required that we had to do some adjustments to our APP. And in most cases, it had nothing to do with the target in the majority of cases, but it had to do with the formulation of indicators in a manner that when the auditor comes, they can be able to say, look, the evidence, we are able to quantify, we are able to actually look at the possible impact or the indicator is properly formulated. We also requested the assistance of the technical advisory unit within the National Treasury to assist in this process because we wanted to make sure that we don't leave someone to chance. And after going through our threat plan that we tabled and the APP, there were a number of areas where they suggested reformulation and most branches sought to really draw a distinction between some indicators which can be left to operational level that is within our work plan and those that should be elevated to the threat plan and the APP. So we had a number of workshops that went through all the processes, and out of the workshop we took a decision that we need to supplement what we have already tabled. And as early as the second quarter, our quarterly monitoring report that we submitted to Treasury and to the NG was in line with the document that we have slightly revised in terms of indicators. And I'm raising this chapter because our annual report at the end of the financial year
the indicators are going to change slightly to be in line with the document that is in table. So out of that process, we then came up with the erratum. Now this erratum was supposed to have been tabled as early as August last year. The hiccups were some of the things that had to do with Treasury, Treasury General, and the AG on the Excel process. And at the end of the day, an agreement was reached to say if you are not fundamentally changing the target in most areas, and what you are doing is much more clarified, what is in your start plan and in line with the smart principles of the new guidelines, then publish and table in Parliament copy of the first plan, something and the ACP, something that we did on the 16th of February this year, and we tabled 60 copies. In order to avoid irregular and fruitless expenditure, we did not go out to publish those copies because we believe that we're supplementing what is already before coming. That's why we presented properly well-bound copies. We provided the number of copies, 60, as per the requirement, the necessary gift, electronic session to Parliament, everything was done in Canada. And what the process actually assisted is that I'm sure there are good departments like us in terms of the 2018 adjustment to the annual performance plan, because we worked with staff and our annual performance plan for 2014 was informed by the extensive work that we did in the election. So those were the issues that actually led to us publishing the election. For ease of reading and to simplify the process, the copies published and tabled in Parliament give you in black what was in the threat and where adjustments were made that highlighted in red, so that you can see where those changes were expected. And that is the reason why we tabled the election. And in short, unless there are specific questions on the session, I will take comments, because it is the background and the change in the guidelines and making sure that moving forward we are in line with the guidelines. And in tomorrow, we will be telling the ACP for 1840, which we believe complies completely with the requirements of Treasury and the Iraqan. Even though we were among the departments that today, some departments chose to retain their own strat plan and retain them in line with the old guidelines, when we also devote and we believe that in the production of our annual report, things will be easier because we have adjusted and moved in line with the Treasury guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Montoya. I think the procedure here would be that our committee members have just write a short report reflecting your presentation here, so it can be sympathetic to the ATC kind of either let us not in the case of change or I don't know if some members want to.
Thank you, Chairperson. You may recall that we have been concerned in the past about the targets, and especially whether all of them are measurable. My question is just, how does this now align with the agreement that the Minister of Labour has signed with President in terms of the performance? I should make sure that this new strategic plan is in line with what the Minister has also performed from now on for the education.
We have something to agree with the position of our people. High note, honorable member, it's been a long day. I would like to propose a meeting closed, and I would request that members of the ANC study group remain behind so we can do our just in our own work.
Yeah.